From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the body responds to long-term stress and why stress can make us sick. We talk with Dr. Bruce McEwen, who has been called the leading living scholar of stress. He has a new book called The End of Stress as We Know It. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, is a great admirer of one of the early TV critics, the late Jack Gould. He wrote about television for the New York Times from 1947, when the medium was in its infancy, until 1972. David will talk with Gould's son, Lou Gould, who has just published a collection of his father's reviews and essays called Watching Television Come of Age. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Chicago-based UAL, the parent company of United Airlines, has received a major setback in its efforts to avoid bankruptcy. A federal panel formed after last year's terrorist attacks is rejecting the airline's request for $1.8 billion in federal loan guarantees. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
For cash-strapped United, the announcement from the Air Transportation Stabilization Board it is rejecting the airline's request for federal loan guarantees makes a bankruptcy filing more likely. The board said not only did it not believe United's business plan was financially sound, it also said it did not feel there was a reasonable assurance the airline would be able to repay the loan. Two board members voted against the application. A third said he would defer his decision until next week in order to give United more time to submit revised financial information. The rejection of the airline's application comes at a time United is in the process of negotiating more than $5 billion in concessions with its unions. United, which is 55% employee-owned, lost more than $2 billion last year and is on track to post even larger losses this year. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
A Catholic Church financial panel has cleared the way for Cardinal Bernard Law to file for bankruptcy on behalf of the Boston Archdiocese. The cardinal would still need approval from the Vatican before taking such an unprecedented step. The archdiocese says bankruptcy may be necessary if it has to pay too much to people who claim they're victims of sexual abuse by priests. An attorney for some of the alleged victims called the announcement a bluff, saying the archdiocese is trying to get plaintiffs to accept a lower settlement. UN weapons inspectors in Iraq visited two more sites today. An Iraqi official said again they still plan on detailing the country's weapons programs as required by the UN. NPR's Anne Garrels is in Baghdad.
The Iraqis say they will provide, quote, a huge amount of material on Saturday, a day earlier than is necessary. They say that that material will include new information, but they say that material will not include anything about weapons of mass destruction, which they continue to deny having. Now this puts them on a direct collision course with the United States. Washington insists it knows Iraq has weapons of mass destruction and demands a full and frank confession, warning it will disarm Iraq by force if necessary.
NPR's Anne Garrels reporting from Baghdad. U.S. and British warplanes attacked targets in northern Iraq today, hitting Iraqi air defense sites for the third time in 4 days. The U.S. military said the coalition jets were patrolling the northern no-fly zone when Iraqi forces fired at them with anti-aircraft guns. In stocks today, the Dow lost 5 points to close at 8,737 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A federal judge in New York has said the court can rule whether Jose Padilla was properly detained as an enemy combatant. Padilla has been accused of plotting with terrorists to detonate a so-called dirty bomb. NPR's Margot Adler has more from New York.
Jose Padilla was arrested May 8th and has been held in a Navy brig since he was declared an enemy combatant in June. The government maintains Padilla met with two Al-Qaeda operatives in a plot to detonate a dirty bomb, and that, as an enemy combatant, he may be held without formal charges. U.S. District Judge Michael Mukasey said the president has constitutional and statutory authority to detain unlawful combatants and that Padilla's U.S. citizenship is irrelevant. But Mukasey said he will decide whether Padilla was lawfully detained and whether there is evidence to support his enemy combatant status. And he said Padilla may meet with his lawyers. The government has argued that such a meeting could imperil security. The judge said there are ways around that. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Britain has closed its embassy in Kenya until further notice because of a terrorist threat. A spokesman at the embassy in Nairobi said the embassy staff received a specific threat, but he declined to give details. The decision to close the embassy comes a week after a terrorist bombing at an Israeli-owned hotel in Kenya and a failed attempt to shoot down an Israeli passenger plane with missiles. President Bush said today that he believes those attacks were the work of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist network. Nairobi was the site of a 1998 bombing at the U.S. embassy that killed 219 people, including 12 Americans. In stocks, the Nasdaq lost 19 points today to close at 1,430. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stress can make us sick. Dr. Bruce McEwen has been studying why. He's written a new book about the paradox of how the human body responds to stress. The physiological response to stress helps us cope in the short term, like pumping adrenaline so that we can run away from danger. But when the stress response is activated over the long term, it can cause damage and accelerate disease. Dr. McEwen's new book is called The End of Stress as We Know It. He's the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University in New York City and specializes in studying the interactions between the brain, the glands, and the immune system. He's coined a new term to describe the long-term effect of stress on our body systems when the stress response turns against us and starts harming the body. That term is allostatic load. I asked him to explain what it means.
There are two parts to it. First, the parent term, allostasis, which is a word that sounds very strange, but it means from the Greek, literally, maintaining stability through change. It's the active coping response, physiologic coping response, how the body expends energy to meet a challenge and usually succeeds in adapting to, at least in the short run, to this challenge and surviving. That's the whole purpose of these systems in the body that help us handle these stressors that we experience. For each event of allostasis, there are downstream consequences for the body. Cells in the brain, cells in the immune system, cells in the heart, cells in the liver, all over the body are responding to the mediators, the hormones, and the neurotransmitters that are produced. But there's another side to this, which is a set of changes in these cells that, if they repeat over and over again, can cause wear and tear and even put the body into a state of what we call pathophysiology, something leading to atherosclerosis, to hardening of the arteries, to changes in the body that are damaging. That we call allostatic load, almost an inevitable cost to the body of being alive, if you will.
So allostasis is what the body does to keep you going when you're exposed, for instance, to great risks or to threats. And allostatic load is the long-term consequences of what your body is doing in the
exactly.
face of stress.
It's the wear and tear that's almost inevitable for organisms that are functioning in an active world.
Let's talk about the difference between the long-term and the short-term effects mm-hmm. of these chemicals on our body when we're under stress. Let's start with adrenaline and the heart rate. When we're under stress, our heart beats more quickly so we could run away from the cause of stress, because the assumption the body's making is that you're being attacked by a lion or an enemy of some sort. So talk about why the heart is beating fast.
Okay. So adrenaline is produced. It gets the heart beating fast so that we can pump the blood to make this mad dash away from a predator. But at the same time, as the heart is pumping, the blood vessels are being expanded and they're being subjected to a certain amount of stress and strain, I mean, in the physical sense. And if this goes on a lot, which it does in all of us, it can cause some minor damage to the blood vessels. And those are places where the atherosclerotic plaques, the fatty deposits that cause these coronary arteries to clog up, they begin to be deposited. So this very act of pumping the blood can also, over long periods of time, cause cumulative wear and tear, leading to atherosclerosis, which is made worse if we're eating a rich diet with a lot of fats and if we have certain genetic predispositions.
Now, let's get to cortisol, which is something that helps you, again, if you're under stress and you need to run away from the enemy. What are some of the bad effects of a long-term increase of cortisol?
Long-term increase of cortisol leads to encourages the metabolic system to produce fat. It also causes muscle proteins to be broken down, to be converted to fat and to usable energy. It causes gradual loss of mineral from bone and weakens bone. And over long periods of time, it can cause cells in the brain to shrink, and under very dire circumstances, it can actually cause some cells to die.
Now, one of the things you consider a real recipe for disaster, if you're under a lot of stress, is eating a big dinner or a big late dinner. Mm-hmm. What does that have to do with stress and with cortisol levels?
It doesn't have a lot to do with stress. This is one of the reasons that we need to look at a broader view of what cortisol is. It's a hormone not only of response to stressful situations in our lives, but it's a basic housekeeping hormone that is secreted in a diurnal rhythm. It's elevated in the morning, and it should go down to low levels at night. And it helps to synchronize our activity, our patterns of eating, our patterns of sleeping. When cortisol is elevated in the evening, and a large meal will cause it to be elevated. A large meal at almost any time of the day will, but in the evening it's particularly dangerous because our liver has a biological clock too. And it happens that our liver's biological clock makes it particularly susceptible to have elevated cortisol in the evening, because that leads then to the conditions that cause the liver to produce more of these bad fats that are deposited in the wrong places in our body.
So eating a lot at night, not a good idea.
Is not a good idea.
And even worse if you're under stress because you've already got a high cortisol
right.
level.
And your stress may cause you to eat more just as a behavioral antidote to feeling better, eating comfort foods because you feel stressed out. So it's a positive feedback loop.
So it's like a vicious cycle.
A vicious cycle, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Bruce McEwen. He's the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at the Rockefeller University in New York City. He studies stress and stress hormones and their effects on the brain. He studies stress and health. His new book is called The End of Stress as We Know It. If most of your cause of stress is happening while you're in a chair, office stress, stress at home where you're, you know, sitting around the dinner table, say, and it's very stressful. Or, you know, people basically are in chair so much of their life now. All of that fight or flight stuff isn't going to be real helpful because you're sitting still.
Yeah.
What happens?
You may be grabbing the wrong things to eat as well.
Yeah, but say you're not. Say you're not even grabbing the wrong things to eat. What are some of the long-term issues that you can get health-wise as a result of this kind of stress if you're not doing much physical activity, if you're basically leading a pretty sedentary life?
One of the most immediate or first signs is an elevation of blood glucose levels, a resistance to your own hormone insulin, the beginnings of what could become type 2 diabetes, which, of course, is very prevalent now.
Well, why is that happening?
I think partly because people are consuming more calories than their bodies need for the amount of energy they expend. They're also using eating as a way of dealing with feeling under pressure. they're responding to the commercialism we see around us in terms of the marketing of food and providing a lot larger meals than we need and feeling the sense that we have to get our money's worth. And so we do consume more than we really need.
Now, hormonally, what's happening that contributes to the glucose problems?
When you eat a fat-rich diet, when you consume a lot of calories, the body is producing more of these same hormones, more cortisol and more adrenaline. Under those conditions, the cortisol and the adrenaline work to make the body, work with insulin to make the body produce more fat. The more calories we have in our bodies leads to something called oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is what is directly responsible for damaging blood vessels in the brain and in the heart, and leading to the production of more what are called inflammatory cytokines. These are hormones of the immune system, but they're also produced by cells throughout the body, by cells in the blood vessel wall linings, by circulating immune cells. These inflammatory cytokines trigger again a cascade of events that increases the deposition of these atherosclerotic plaques.
My guest is Dr. Bruce McEwen, author of the new book, The End of Stress as We Know It. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Bruce McEwen. He studies the long-term effects of stress on the body. Part of what you do is study the body's response to stress and all the different hormones that are secreted, the changes in neurotransmitters, and basically the biological response of the body to stress. If you were to examine a patient, could you tell by studying the release of these hormones and other secretions in the body, how much stress the person was under and how their body was reacting to it? In other words, is there a kind of more medical, biological diagnosis of stress now that we're capable of?
There is. I mean, the beginning, which is still very useful, is the measure of things like your cholesterol level, your high-density lipoproteins. This is part of a biological diagnosis of the allostatic load that your body is experiencing. We can expand that and have in studies that are done on fairly large groups of people to look at how their health is affected by various things like their education and income and so on by measuring things like their waist-hip ratio, the amount of abdominal fat that they have. We can measure overnight production or in urine of cortisol and of adrenaline. And remember I said that it's supposed to come down at night. So in the sleeping hours, if it's elevated, that's a particularly sensitive time to tell you that the system is out of regulation. We can measure systolic and diastolic blood pressure. We can measure these things called inflammatory cytokines. We can measure something we haven't talked about yet, which is called heart rate variability, which is a sign of how it's like a shock absorber in your car. The heart rate has a beat-to-beat frequency, which is not perfectly regular. And there's a certain amount of variability in that, which helps to reduce the shock on the blood vessels that can accelerate atherosclerosis. And if you have low heart rate variability, then your system, your cardiovascular system, is much more vulnerable to the shock effects that will cause the atherosclerotic plaques.
But should we try to, like, chemically intervene in the body's response to stress? Like, if there's too much cortisol, should we be trying to manufacture a cortisol inhibitor?
Okay. And that's also a very interesting question. I think not, because one of the things, there is a cortisol inhibitor, which is actually the same. It's called RU486. Is the same as the drug that causes termination of pregnancy, because it will block not only the progesterone receptor, which is involved in pregnancy, but also the glucocorticoid receptor, which is involved in doing the things we're talking about. It has a different name, mifepristone. If you use it, the cortisol levels go up, because what you're doing is you're blocking negative feedback. So you give mifepristone and your cortisol levels go up, but the high levels of cortisol can, for the most part, do nothing because the receptors are being blocked, at least temporarily. However, this is not a good situation, because there are some things that cortisol does which are not blocked by mifepristone. So those things will go on because there's more cortisol in the body. So this is not a good solution to prevent the effects of cortisol. It is a good solution and has been used in something called psychotic depression. People who are depressed and have hallucinations. There's no other treatment available except electroconvulsive shock therapy, and there is a new attempt to use mifepristone to help to bring the psychotic attacks under control. I mean, one other aspect, maybe we haven't talked about the brain yet, and there are some really interesting aspects that sort of parallel the immune system and that get into exactly what we're talking about now. So I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I would. Well, what are some of the interesting things you're learning about mood, for instance?
Well, let's go back to the basic idea that in, for example, the immune system, the acute stress response, these hormones help the immune system fight an infection. But chronically, they can cause problems, impairment of immune function. The brain is just the same way. There's a part of the brain that we have studied for many years called the hippocampus, which is named because it looked like a seahorse tail to early anatomists. And it's very important for learning and memory, the kind of memory that helps us keep track of events in our daily lives, what you're going to do this afternoon, what you did yesterday and this morning. It also keeps us oriented towards where we are. And it's the part of the brain that helps us remember where we were and what we were doing when, for example, September 11th occurred, the sort of indelible memories associated with place and time. When the hippocampus begins to fail, as it does in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, we lose that contact with who we are, with our daily lives, with the events. The hippocampus is very sensitive to stress hormones, to cortisol especially. But like the acute response in the immune system, these hormones actually help us remember where we were and what we were doing. They have a very important effect to stamp into our memories so that we can, the next time a situation like this occurs, we can perhaps avoid it. If it was like the place that where you ran into the lion, if you know not to go back there or to be particularly wary, that's going to help you survive another lion attack. That's the good side of stress hormone effects on the brain, on the hippocampus. The bad side is when we get into this chronic stress dysregulation, then the hippocampus shows allostatic load. Its nerve cells begin to shrink. Memory becomes impaired. There's part of the hippocampus which generates new nerve cells continuously through adult life, and these replacement of these cells is presumably very important for our ability to learn and remember things. This ability to produce new nerve cells is suppressed by chronic stress and even by certain kinds of acute stress. So the brain is very much part of the same system, showing this protection in the short run and damage in the long run, as all of these other systems of the body. And when we talk about mood, we talk about remembering where you were and what you were doing. if you have a functioning hippocampus, you are better able to associate place and time with a very emotionally powerful set of events. If you don't have a functioning hippocampus, then you're going to generalize. And the same cues that you can say, okay, this took place yesterday, and I don't have to be worried about it today because it's a totally different situation. You may not be able to do that because, in fact, you generalize. People who have depression, people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, tend to not be able to associate place and time, and they have then free-floating anxieties and flashbacks and things of that sort, which are at least partly related to having a malfunctioning hippocampus.
Dr. Bruce McEwen is the author of the new book, The End of Stress as We Know It. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by WorldCom, an update on management and policy is available at worldcom.com/update. And Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides. Providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the body's response to stress with Dr. Bruce McEwen. Also, a new book collects the reviews and essays of one of the first TV critics, the late Jack Gould. He covered TV for the New York Times from 1947 to 72. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, will talk with Gould's son, historian Lou Gould, who edited the book.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Bruce McEwen, the author of the new book, The End of Stress as We Know It. McEwen is the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University in New York. He studies the effects of long-term stress on the body, the impact stress has on our glands, our immune system, and the brain. Are there any implications for the research you're doing now on the effects of stress on the body? Any implications for things like chronic fatigue syndrome and these new mysterious syndromes that people seem to be developing that aren't easily diagnosed? Some doctors aren't even sure they exist. But for the people who are suffering from them, they know they have no strength, no energy, and they're very prone to all kinds of illnesses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, certainly chronic pain and chronic fatigue, something that's called multiple chemical sensitivities, which amounts to probably the same set of syndromes, a debilitation, lack of energy, are indeed very mysterious. And most likely they are related to an imbalance in the system I mentioned earlier, that is, inflammatory cytokines are produced in bursts, and they will make us feel very tired and even sick. Most of the evidence suggests that it's related to an imbalance, too much of these inflammatory cytokines, too little of the counter-regulatory systems like the cortisol, which can bring these systems under control. It's hard to document, to actually show that this is the main cause. I think that there are new attempts to really bring these disorders under some sort of more careful medical diagnosis. The question is then, what do you do about them? You have to somehow reduce these bursts of these inflammatory cytokines. It's not easy to figure out a way of doing this, but it is a direction that a lot of this research is moving, and I wouldn't be surprised over the next several years as if there will be some better sort of medical understanding of these conditions.
One of the larger problems we seem to be facing now in terms of stress and how our bodies respond to it is that our bodies are hardwired from the dawn of man era, when stress did mean that, you know, a brontosaurus was attacking, or some creature was attacking and you had to run away. I mean, do you think our bodies will ever adapt to the fact that the kind of stresses that we're often facing now are different? They're mental stresses. They're desk-related stresses. Mm-hmm. They're relationship stresses. And the response our body is providing for us isn't necessarily the response that we need.
Right. And I think we're talking about what direction will evolution be taking us, what selection is made for people who are able to handle this kind of modern life stress.
Do you think our bodies will ever adapt to that?
Well, I think, I mean, one factor that is very important is this social support aspect. And people who, by their nature, are able to go out and establish networks of social contacts are doing themselves a big favor, because they're able not perhaps to directly deal with the sources of their stress, but to deal with how they handle them by perhaps realizing through interactions with other people that there are other aspects to life that are worth living, and relationships are as important or more important than the things that are causing them grief, and help to find a way to actually circumvent these situations. And, of course, ultimately, if you're in a difficult job or a difficult relationship, you may have to leave it to find some other way of some other kind of relationship or some other kind of job. To have the courage to do that also requires good social skills and good ability to make decisions. So I think it's those kind of qualities that are perhaps, if you will, being selected for by evolution on top of this basic system, which is still very helpful when we get into dire emergencies.
Well, Dr. McEwen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Bruce McEwen is the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University. His new book is called The End of Stress as We Know It. We're going to take a minute to say happy birthday to guitarist Jim Hall, who is 72 today. Here's a track from Hall's new CD, Downbeat Critic's Choice. This is a piece that he composed and arranged called Circus Dance. Coming up, our TV critic David Bianculli talks with historian Lou Gould, the son of one of the first TV critics, Jack Gould. This is Fresh Air. After World War II, when radio began to give way to a new medium called television, the New York Times responded by assigning its radio writer to cover TV on a regular basis. That writer was Jack Gould, who became one of the first and most influential TV critics at a time when the medium was fresh and experimental. He reviewed Howdy Doody, I Love Lucy, Marty, and See It Now. He also wrote essays about TV's big issues of the day, from the quiz show scandals and blacklisting to the increasing popularity and impact of television itself. Gould covered TV for The Times from 1947 until 1972 and died in 1993. His son, Louis L. Gould, a professor of American history at the University of Texas at Austin, sifted through thousands of his father's reviews and essays and has just published a book collecting 70 of his father's most historical, original, and passionate columns. The book is called Watching Television Come of Age, The New York Times Reviews by Jack Gould. Lou Gould provides historical context for each entry, and we dispatched our own television critic, David Bianculli, of the New York Daily News, to seek some historical perspective on Lou Gould and his late father. In 1947, when Jack Gould began reviewing television, he moved his family to Stamford, Connecticut, and began working from home.
Well, he believed that he should see television, which was mostly live in those days, except for, you know, the old movies and things, that he should see it the way people at home saw it. And this imposed on him severe deadlines because the Times had to put the paper to bed by, I guess, 11:30 at night. So when the programs ended at 11, he had about 15 to 17 minutes to write a 300-word review. It was a gut-wrenching experience for him, but he learned how to do it, and then he would call them up and dictate his piece over the phone to the city desk, and it would appear the next day.
Well, take us into the Gould living room or the TV room back then. When he started, you would have been, what, 8, 7? How old?
Yeah, I really am not too familiar with it until I was in my early teens, which would be in the early 50s. He didn't like much in the way of disturbances, and young boys tended to be more disturbing than encouraging. And there's some, if you read some of the pieces where he talks about us bouncing on the sofas and otherwise distracting him, you'll get a sense of how we could drive him crazy. But by the early 50s, as we got to be more mature in our early teens, I at least, he would ask us in the watch, and we could sit there as long as we didn't say anything. And then when he was done, he would say, "That's it," and that was our cue to get out of the room, and the typewriter would start away. By the time I got to college, I could sit in the room and watch him type and still not say anything. And then sometimes he would let us read the pieces and see what we thought of them. It was an awe-inspiring experience. I can remember one occasion when we were watching one of the televised national political conventions, and Huntley and Brinkley were on a set where they were very close together. And he said, "It looks like those guys are playing kneesies out there." And the phone rang, and it was somebody from NBC, and he said, "By the way, are Chet and David playing kneesies out there?" And about 5 minutes later, over the air, Huntley and Brinkley said, "Someone in the East says we may be playing kneesies out here." And I thought, that is amazing stuff.
That is amazing.
But most of the time, he didn't, you know, get involved in the actual program, but just watched.
Before we get more into what your father thought of television as one of the first professionals critiquing it, what you thought of television, because I figured you guys had to have TVs before just about anybody else in the neighborhood. You had to be watching television before just about anybody else. What were your earliest memories?
Well, we always sat too close, and we were already flipping the dial to the point where on some sets, the family set that we had in the den, that we broke the handle, the channel changer, because we would flip it too much. These were very delicate instruments and had little ball bearings inside, and we would smooth them out, and my father would come in and say, "You got to sit back, and you can't keep flipping that channel." So we were ready for those clickers 30 years before they were ever invented. And I guess we were as much television hounds as all the kids to follow us would be. We also had... He had three television sets almost from the beginning for his where he watched in the den. And when people later said that Lyndon Johnson had three sets, I thought, gee, didn't everybody have three sets? You had to monitor the networks.
That's funny. When you were looking at your father's columns and gathering them, did you get a different sense in retrospect of how important he was?
Yes, I had a sense that he was important sort of anecdotally, and I knew it later, but the sheer range of what he wrote about and the number of subjects that he covered and the way in which people responded to him, I think really impressed me. I was just the volume of his work as a critic. I knew it was large, but I had no concept of how large and how eclectic he was in the things that he was interested in.
It is interesting when you read the columns 50 years later, and he's writing about Lucille Ball. He's writing about Rod Serling. He's writing about Patty Chayefsky. And now these people are Lucille Ball, you know, Patty Chayefsky, Rod Serling. They're icons. But back then, they were just other, you know, performers, writers, and you're seeing icons being shaped. And go ahead. I just wonder.
Well, but this was what was on Tuesday, and he would go in there and sit down, and you didn't. Part of the excitement of it was that you might have a Marty or a Patterns. Now, sometimes you had a clinker and a dud, but when those magical moments came with a play that, like the Julius Caesar or Patterns or the Days of Wine and Roses, there was an immediacy and a power about it that whatever the technical quality of television now, and it's impressive, I don't think it has that same sense that it was an event and that the next day when you went to school or talked to people, they would say, did you see that last night? And that sense of a shared experience of people in the late 40s and early 50s is something, I guess, except for, you know, cable or some news broadcast now, there's not that sense of excitement.
Did your father's tastes strike you as odd in any respect in looking over these things?
Well, his tastes in culture generally tended to be pretty congruent with mine. I suppose that's the normal for growing up with somebody, though I was more interested in modern jazz than he was. I had not realized how much he was involved as a young reporter with the nightclub scene in New York, jazz, and the swing era. He wrote a terrific article about Count Basie and how black bands at that time were discriminated against by white booking agents, which I was quite surprised to find, gratified but surprised. But he had a kind of New York theatrical kind of sensibility. As I say in the book, he thought Rodgers and Hart were terrific and was less impressed with Rodgers and Hammerstein, which is a continuing debate in that area. Not having gone to college, he was somewhat sensitive about his intellectual credentials and defensive in some instances on that. He seemed to be a very well-read and interesting man in the way that he dealt with opera, shows like Omnibus, and things where there was a range of artistic development involved. So I came to have a great deal of respect. He was obviously reading more than I thought as a child when he seemed to be, too busy to talk to me.
Was it his passion for the moral issues that had him write so many columns, or at least so many that you collected in the book, about blacklisting, about the quiz show scandals?
Well, of course, as you know, reporters tend to have a deep well of cynicism about human nature, but there's also a vein of idealism in the best of them. And he was, I think it's fair to say, allowing for prejudice, a very moral man in his view of what the networks and television should be. And he had a sense of fair play. And I think the biggest reason he was outraged by blacklisting and the quiz show scandals is that the networks had really betrayed the faith of their audience. And that, he, I think, believed was unforgivable. That it was they had the power, they had the influence over society, and it was up to them to play fair and to do the right thing. And so in some ways, now a naive and innocent view, but I must say, reading back on it, I found it as attractive now as I did at the time.
We're listening to our TV critic, David Bianculli, speaking with Lou Gould, who has just published a book collecting the reviews and essays of his father, the late TV critic Jack Gould. We'll continue the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, is an admirer of the late Jack Gould, who was the TV critic for the New York Times from 1947 to 72. Gould's reviews and essays have been collected in a new book edited by his son, Lou Gould. Let's get back to David's interview with Lou Gould about his father.
Lou, I think the next thing I'd like to ask you to do is to pick your own favorite passage from the book and maybe read a paragraph from it. If there's something that you can single out that as a son, as an historian, for whatever reason, that you're especially proud of being able to disseminate in this new form.
I think the thing that impressed me was the See It Now column from 1951, November 19, 1951, where he talks about Murrow and his trip to Korea. And they have a documentary film made in Korea, and it talks about the soldiers on the front. And when we think about North Korea and the axis of evil and the problems that we have today, it makes you realize how short history is and how much we're still living with the results of the 1950s.
Well, go ahead and read it for us, please.
The last half of the program was devoted to a documentary film that CBS had taken in Korea. It showed all the hardship, good humor, and tension of the average soldier's existence at the front. The film was tough and real, but always thoughtful. And Mr. Murrow's sparing comments cut to the viewer's heart. When the film showed the GIs digging their foxholes, he remarked, "If you dig before dark, you have a better chance of living until light." Then came the climax. One by one, the soldiers stepped before the camera and merely gave their name and hometown. Mr. Murrow reported on what had happened to the company since the film was made. 50 casualties. With searching eyes, Mr. Murrow looked straight at the camera and said that some of the wounded might need blood. "Can you spare a pint?" he asked. To television, in short, finally has come Mr. Murrow's rare feeling for the value of understatement in reporting the news and telling the facts as they are. Those qualities obviously were a source of inspiration for all who contributed to the success of See It Now, and more important, to the persons privileged to watch their efforts. Television had a taste of its true glory yesterday. I can't read that every time I read that. I choke up a little bit. I remember seeing the program, but it just seemed to me that was Dad at the top of his form. And Murrow, too.
Now, he was a television critic. We've been focusing on the early years of television because that's just so fascinating to me anyway. For him to start in 1947 as a television critic, but he actually didn't retire as a TV critic until 1972. So he had a large body of work. What was your sense of him in the later decades in terms of his relationship with television?
I think he became progressively more disillusioned. He would say that he was written out, that he'd spent 20 years glued to the tube, that he was repeating himself, that he had nothing new to say. And I think some of that was true. It was a high-tension job that wore him out physically and emotionally. But I also think that by the mid-60s, he had the sense that whatever the promise of television had been 15 years earlier, it was not to be realized, or it didn't seem to be realized. And after the Newton Minow episode in the early 60s with the Kennedy administration and the vast wasteland issues. that was not going to change, I think he became convinced that repetition and money-making and the high ratings were going to dominate, and that television, while it would have its moments, was not something to which he wanted to devote the rest of his life. And I think it was time. He was only a man in his late 50s by the time he retired, but he had said most of what he wanted to say and most of what he could say. And there was an arc to his career that told him that it was time to move on. And it was clear that it was.
When your dad finally decided that he'd had enough of television and retired in 1972, what did he do then?
He spent most of the time watching television, actually.
Let that be a lesson to you.
Well, he got a satellite dish early on when they retired to California, and he would spend time watching the Canadian Parliament. And he also loved to listen to police bands and airline pilots on the radio and the shortwave radio. So some ways he went back to his roots and just followed television and radio as a fan of the sort of more technical inside aspects of the business, the way daily life was carried on by people who communicated, not so much for the public, but among themselves, but also using what he could of satellite technology. So he also slept a lot because of circulatory problems and things.
Well, Lou Gould, I'm so glad that you came to join us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you for having me.
Lou Gould spoke with Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli. Gould has edited a book of TV reviews and essays by his late father, Jack Gould. It's called Watching Television Come of Age. Two classic TV themes are featured on a new CD by someone who specializes in American popular song, Michael Feinstein. The composers of those themes, Jay Livingston and Ray Evans, also wrote songs for Bob Hope, Rosemary Clooney, and Doris Day. Feinstein performs the songs of Livingston and Evans on his new CD. Livingston joins Feinstein to sing and play his two TV themes.
We got a right to pick a little fight bonanza. If anyone fights any one of us, he's gonna fight with me. We're not a run to saddle up and run bonanza. Any one of us who starts a little fuss knows he can count on me. One for four, four for one, that's how it must be. We'll make our stand on our land, this we guarantee. We got a right to pick a little fight bonanza. If anyone fights any one of us, he's gonna fight with me.
This is the night I'm gonna hit a bright bonanza. I'm in a whirl with a pretty little girl, and she's in love with me. I'm gonna light the middle of the night bonanza. I'm gonna go with a glitter in the glow, that's how it's gonna be. I'm in love, she's in love, we don't have to guess. I'll unfold more than gold when she answers yes. This is the deal that's gonna bring a real bonanza. I'm in a whirl with a pretty little girl, and she's in love with me.
A horse is a horse, of course, of course, and no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Red. Go right to the source and ask the horse, he'll give you the answer that you endorse. He's always on a steady course, talk to Mr. Red. People yakety yak a streak and waste your time of day, but Mr. Ed will never speak unless he has something to say. A horse is a horse, of course, of course, and this one won't talk to his voice, his horse. You never heard of a talking horse. Well, listen to this.
I am Mr. Ed.
Songwriter Jay Livingston with Michael Feinstein from Feinstein's new CD, The Livingston and Evans Songbook. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services organization providing nearly 3 million members with financial products and services, online at thrivent.com, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Aisha Imam, a women's rights activist in Nigeria, where rioting broke out over the Miss World pageant. Imam has campaigned against the adoption of a conservative Muslim judicial system. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.